Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm speaking to you from New York City. This is the fifth day of May, 2020. And as always, I'd like to thank each of you for listening to the show and making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel. And I want to invite you to keep your questions, comments, whatever you have to say about this show, send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions, the number four, taylor@gmail.com. I also want to thank our sponsors for making the show economically viable. Without them, there would be no show. Sponsors today, RN Resources, Ely Gold Royalties, Great Bear Resources, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, and Sitka Gold Corp. Before I introduce today's show, there are a couple of announcements that I would like to make. First, on May 14th, 2020, that's just coming up in another a little more than a week from now, I'll be a part of the Virtual Metals Investor Forum, a live event that will take place. Gwen Preston, Brian London, and myself as newsletter writers will be inviting some of our favorite companies along to present their stories, and each of us will also be providing our views of the markets. So Gwen Preston, Brian London, and myself, you know, the best way to make money in this mining sector, the one that I'm so involved with, is to learn about great companies before they become widely known. And that's what the Metals Investor Forum is all about. Unlike other resource investor conferences, the Metals Investor Forum brings you a curated list of companies followed by one or more of the newsletter writers that host it. In other words, the companies that present there are not just companies because they have some money, they can come on and do their part there and tell their story, but they have to be vetted by one of the newsletter writers. So each of us will be inviting our favorite, a few of our favorite companies along. That is on the 14th of May. Now, you should go to J Taylor Media. There's a banner there. You need to register for this. Go there, click on that banner at J Taylor Media. And provide your email, and then you'll be able to get in and listen to this live event that will be starting at around noon, I believe it is, in New York time. But if you go there, it will give you the exact time and information that you need. I should just mention that a good example of how you can profit from this event, Great Bear Resources, and I see it's up to $8.50. Gwen Preston was the first newsletter writer to bring it to my attention, to bring it to the attention of the Metals Investor Forum people in Vancouver a couple of years ago. I believe I picked it up at 46 cents or something like that in my newsletter. Well, today I just checked and said $8.50. It's trading very, very strongly, and I think it probably has quite a ways to go yet. Of course, Great Bear is a sponsor of this show. Chris Taylor has been on this program numerous times and will be with us again in the not-too-distant future. The second announcement that I'd like to make is that I would like to encourage you to go to Jay Taylor, go to miningstocks.com. Go to miningstocks.com because I post every day company news. It's very important. But if you scroll down a little bit, you'll also find some real headline economic headlines that are very, very important at this time, and things that I really pick out that I think are very significant and important. So, for example, the ISM PMI surveys numbers collapse in U.S. GDP heading much lower. These are things that you can go to miningstocks.com, click on the links. Here's another one. Will the market retest lows for the summer? Lance Roberts provides information on that. U.S. trade deficit widens on record crash in exports. Another article. Why It's Different This Time by Charles Hugh Smith. These are just a few of the very important news and essays that you can pick up from miningstocks.com. So go there and avail yourself to that. A quick and easy way to get to a lot of different very important thoughts on today's markets, some very challenging markets that we are now facing. Well, today's show I've titled Monetary Madness and Three Outcomes for Gold. Dan Oliver and Chen Lin are this week's guests. Nature gave us gold for money and currency. It is the best form of money known to man, not only for economic stability and prosperous and for a prosperous egalitarian capitalist society, but also to ensure economic stability through an ongoing market adjustments that occur when markets are free. But increasingly since 1971, when President Nixon did remove gold from the international monetary system. We've had the opposite system that has led us to a redistribution of income from people who create wealth, like the miners, the manufacturers, the farmers, the inventors, to a ruling elite in the financial markets and in government. Now, those classes of people become very rich at the expense of Americans' once thriving middle classes. And in the process, with money created out of thin air, the entire global monetary system has become much less stable with each credit cycle. Now we are facing what many think could very well be a depression even greater than that of the 1930s, thanks to this ruling elite, which have become very, very wealthy complements of our dishonest fiat monetary system that has enabled that to take place. Turning hard times into good times is about finding ways for average folks, like most of you who listen to this show, to turn what are hard times into at least wealth-preserving situations, and if possible, finding ways to actually increase your wealth by honest measures that help our fellow citizens in the process. So to start with, you need to be able to save your wealth. But how can that be done when we don't even know what shape this impending downturn will take? Will it be a deflationary depression like that of the 1930s, or will it be an inflationary depression? Well, Dan Oliver will be with me in the second segment of today's show to outline three possible outcomes and what that may mean for gold and gold share investments through the impending downturn. We do have to go to break now, but when we come back, Chen Lin will be with me to give us his view on COVID-19, his thoughts on the biotech sector, some prospects perhaps for the biotech sector, and some stocks that he may think will give you a chance to profit from it. Chen has done very well, and in fact, I believe has just recently made some money with a COVID-19 biotech stock. But we'll hear what he has to say right as soon as we come back from the commercial break, so don't go away. I'll be right back with Chen Lin.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Chen Lin with me. Welcome, Chen. Thanks for joining me again. Well, great to have you as always. I know that you're very well plugged into what's going on in China. At least you have a lot of friends in China yet, and you talk to them on a regular basis. So I have a couple of questions that's related to COVID-19 and the trade wars and other things. We do have, unfortunately, seemingly a growing tension between the United States and China. But with respect to COVID-19, Chen, China has about, when I looked at the Johns Hopkins University website, they keep track of every country in the world, how many cases that are reported and how many deaths, and a lot of statistics there. And they show that China has only about 7% as many cases, I believe, as the U.S., and yet it has more than four times our population. Quite naturally, a lot of Americans are wondering how reliable are those statistics, and I just thought I'd ask you if you have an opinion about that.
Yes, hi, Jay. This is a very good question. I got a lot of questions from friends, even subscribers on this topic. Sometimes it's a little bit sensitive, because there's the political things in between, but I'm looking for facts, right? And all my career, I'm just looking for real deal, right? Real stock, real fact. And then what I have is I talked to doctors in China. In Wuhan, it's very different. Wuhan, because people just die in their home. People just was locked down, right? So people may have a little symptom, and then they cure themselves. So, and then testing was not widely available, especially in the first month. So Wuhan is a black hole. Okay, so actually nobody, even doctor told me they're probably much higher than they estimate, but we don't know. But I know that outside Wuhan, the data is almost as good as you can get. You know, China, they basically track every patient. So Jay, if you were in China, okay, so you will know how many of your neighbors on your street have a COVID, which restaurant they went to, which shopping center, which supermarket they went. So actually, all this data is available on your cell phone, okay, on an app. So it's very hard to miss, you know, or misinterpret a single case. So what I said, exactly what I have now is that 3 months ago when we were at PDAC for the Metals Investment Forum, my presentation was, I look at China, I cave out Wuhan, and this is a black hole. Outside China, I look at the fatality versus the infection. Those, I believe, is almost as good as you can get. And I came out with a number at 0.8%. Okay, that was my presentation 3 months ago. It's still now. I really stand by the number. And right now you can see the number keep changing. Some say 10%, some say less than 1%. Right now even Dr. Fauci recently said it's about 1%. So after all these months, actually I feel I was right. The number, the estimate I have, 0.8, about 0.8, you know, is probably the real fatality rate of the COVID-19. And it's from China, outside Wuhan. So I believe those data are very accurate.
Well, that's interesting because 0.8, of course, is much, much higher. 1% is much, much higher than the flu. Usually it's 0.1% or something like that. But it also seems, Chen, that there's an awful lot of people who may have had it, who are asymptomatic, who have had it. We just don't really know yet, I guess. But you're saying you're pretty confident with that. So I guess that makes a lot of sense. As you say, you're just looking for the facts. And Okay, well, before the COVID issue came alive, of course, we had this trade warfare with President Trump launched a trade warfare against the Chinese. And how do you think this? I mean, this certainly doesn't make things better. If anything, this tension that seems to be because you know it's I know every country has their propaganda, Chen. So I don't want to say one country has. You know, is telling the truth and the other country is telling lies. I mean, there's a mixture of both, I suppose, from everybody. But of course, there is this, there's this view in America and the propaganda from here is that China launched this or they didn't care or they left the virus come to America and they were indifferent about and they sent people around the world, but they didn't leave people travel in China. So there is obviously a growing animosity between the two countries. What are your thoughts about that? And maybe combine that with the trade war. Do you think they're combined somehow, or do you think one might have followed the other? Or what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's a very unfortunate event, I think, what happened with COVID. And I was hoping, you know, that we can get along, but right now it does not look like, right? There's a growing blame from United States, especially politicians on China. And then there's a lot of pushback from China. I can see even the ordinary people in China, they feel they're being humiliated. Okay, actually, they push people. Actually, there are a lot of people don't like the government in China. They're actually pushing them more towards the communists, right? So the party. So it's a big issue. It probably takes a long time to explain, but it's very very, very bad. I feel very bad because I saw, you know, like a couple of weeks ago, I saw, the corn, you know, they couldn't harvest because they couldn't get out. They plow with all these farmers. I feel so bad. I said China probably can come in to buy those cheap corn and then show them, you know, give them a goodwill to the American farmer.
Sure.
So I was buying in DBA the corn, but it's not happening. You know what I mean? So this is a something is beyond us. It's very unfortunate. It could be a win-win situation, but it's not. It's getting worse. So for all I've been hearing, the two countries, it actually is getting worse. And so actually, but what happened was, if you look at back almost a year and a half ago when the trade war started, actually that's when gold turned around and started moving to a new high. So remember that was December of 2018, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when the trade war started. But so I think this round looks like they're going to aren't together, United States and China, another round of trade war, and it will be very positive for gold. Okay, and I have seen today is the 19th day we have consecutive increase of the ETF holding, all the gold added together. Today is 19th day. Happened 20 day. If there's a 20 day consecutive, it happened once in 2009 and once in 2010. What happened was a year from that, go up average by 50%. Okay, so if we continue to increase, I see we will, the gold ETF increase today and tomorrow. We'll have 20 days. And I really see gold to go to 3,000. That's my target.
3,000, what time frame, Chen?
Well, by the end of next year, I say, potentially. It depends on a lot of factors, Jay. And then depending, it may even go down first. Because I was talking to explain to my subscribers, we are living at the mercy of the Bridgewater, as all these big hedge funds. They're heavily into gold. If they have redemption, if they have liquidation, they sell gold. That's what happened when gold hit 1450 recently, right? It was a hedge fund selling. Now, last month, every month I check their performance, Jay. Last month, Bridgewater had a very good month so because they are shorting oil. At least I can sleep better. At least they will not be selling, at least in the near term. But who knows what's going to happen in the future.
Hey, all right, Chen. Well, just with a couple of minutes left here yet, you've done very well in the biotech sector. Do you see some things you like that any biotechs that are involved with COVID-19 projects?
Well, I had, I'm very fortunate. This year I got a 10-bagger out of my investment. It's called Corpicon, CAPR. I got in, everybody was on sale at below a dollar, went to 11. Last week. Yeah, it was very nice. So the company is doing a raise yesterday, so it's good. It came down today, even it's a good day. If it really goes down before the next data come out, I may take another look. So that's the thing I'm very excited. But in general, I feel the biotech, in general, is in the breakout mode. Mm-hmm. I feel of the COVID, you look at all the sectors, all the airline, all the cruise, all the other hotel, they're very hard to predict the future. But there are company can predict, which is a pharmaceutical and gold company who doesn't, who can go through this shutdown, right? So the short shutdown period.
Right.
So I feel the gold and biotech are the two best sectors right now.
Very good, Chen. We're going to have to leave it go at that. And I just would like to tell people it's chenpicks.com to consider subscribing to Chen's letter. It's an excellent letter. It's not inexpensive, but if you're a serious investor, you might do very well to consider subscribing. And Chen has done extremely well, especially in the biotech sector and the gold mining sector as well. So please do yourself a favor and go to chenpicks.com. Chen, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll do it again sometime soon. Folks, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away. Dan Oliver will be with us right afterwards. Dan has three different outcomes he's going to talk about, how this impending economic decline could shake out. One is his favorite, so stay tuned and hear what Dan Oliver thinks is most likely to happen as we go forward into the rest of this year.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer, wholly owned Dixie project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Ontario. having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete a very active 200,000-meter drill program through to the year 2021. Stay up to date on what has been considered one of the best-performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with us once again Dan Oliver. Dan is the managing director of Mermican Capital, and he has also had he's also been managing money for some time. He has an MBA from INSED. He has a couple of degrees from Vanderbilt in English and philosophy, and he has a law degree from Columbia. But most importantly, from my point of view, Dan is a critical and logical thinker, and that's why he's so valuable to us. Dan, I've titled today's show, Inflation, Good and Hard. That's after your Mermican research missive dated April 13th, because I want people to really perceive what the opportunities might be for them to protect their wealth against what seems like potentially the worst economic environment that I've lived through in my 73 years on Earth. When you are talking about 30 million Americans unemployed and counting, I don't think it's an overstatement to refer to what we're facing as a depression. I wish it weren't so, but that seems to be what I see anyway. And if that's true, it's going to mean a tougher time for virtually everyone, wealthy people as well, to an extent. But you and I both believe history shows owning gold in one form or another helps to preserve wealth and soften the blow. People need to start off by owning gold bullion and secondarily owning mining shares. And I know that Mermican Capital there at that company, you do both. So I would like to discuss what you think is the likely outcome for both gold bullion and gold shares. As gold shares were hit really hard with the rest of the equity markets in March, even though the price of gold held steady. In fact, I'm looking at the price. My average price of gold for March was $1,592. That's only $5 lower than in February. And yet the gold shares, in spite of declining energy prices, massively lower energy prices, you would think that the margins for gold mining shares probably going up. And yet the gold mining shares really got slammed hard. And how do you account for that?
Well, I mean, John, I think it's pretty obvious that what happened was when the liquidity ended in the market and everyone had to raise cash quickly, they had to sell whatever they have. If you've got a brokerage account and you've got Tesla in it or any other stock and it gets crushed and all of a sudden you get a margin call, you sell what you have to, not what you want to. So I think that was – the reason I say it's obvious is because the gold mining shares have bounced so hard. I mean, of course, you're right. If gold's going up and the costs of mining are going down, then obviously the value of the firms have to be going up. And as you say, they didn't at first. They went down. And so I think we can deduce reasonably that it was a liquidity event. But I want to step back and address your earlier point about the U.S. facing a depression. And really, there are two different kinds of depressions, and that is the deflationary kind, which is the 1930s, which we can read about in history books, where prices collapsed and the stock market collapsed. And you went through 10 years of horrible economic conditions. And you can also have an inflationary depression. I mean, the 70s was a mild one. Weimar Germany is more of an extreme case. But in that case, you still get depressionary conditions, but prices go up instead of down. And it's hard to prepare for a depression because you don't know which way it's going to go. And to that question, I would just point out that if you read economists' papers and follow the current economic thinking of in the university, which of course then filters into the Federal Reserve and policymaking, is the whole structure of the discipline is to avoid a 1930s outcome, a banking collapse, where whereby prices go down, you can't pay your debt, the bank blows up, and everyone loses their deposits. And so they will print and print and print and print some more to avoid that outcome, because that's in their DNA. They are set to be having the inflationary outcome and not the deflationary outcome. And this isn't my theory. This was stated by Powell himself the other day when he gave I think it was the Brookings Institute, and someone asked him about all this money printing and inflation. And he said bluntly, we don't care about inflation.
Yeah.
This is an existential banking crisis, which it is. Because, again, if they let prices collapse, the banks will all go down. It doesn't matter what the balance sheets look like. They'll all go down. And so we said, look, our job, we didn't say this, but their job was to save the banks. And so, therefore, they're going to, they call it the economy, but it's really the banks.
Yes.
So we're going to print as much money as we can to avoid that outcome. And so I think this informs what investors should do, because I do think that, of course, the stock market's in the bubble, and, of course, prices are all too high. But and I wouldn't be surprised at all. In fact, I expect to have deflationary impulse moves as the market tries to apply rational valuations to various companies. But whenever that happens, the Fed's going to run in and print the money to save the day, save the banks, and save the real people who matter in this country. And that is, look who run policy economics and the policy making institutions. It's most people from Goldman Sachs or from Powell himself was a partner at the private equity firm Carlyle, so the private equity has a huge influence. These are who their friends are. They don't know anyone who runs a diner that employs three people. That's just not on the radar. What's on the radar is BlackRock and Blackstone and all these huge organizations. And so they get phone calls from these people saying, oh, my God, we're going to go bankrupt, and they'll print the money. And so I think that's again, you have to be prepared for lurching moves lower in pricing, because that's what the market wants to do.
Yes.
But then you also have to realize when that happens, the Fed's going to run in. And this is why I've stated often, I didn't know myself which way gold would lurch when the bubble finally popped. Obviously, I didn't know that this Wuhan virus was going to come. But, something was going to come. There's always some event that pricks a bubble. And the question was, would gold get crushed the first way it did in 2008, or would it soar? There were reasons on either side, but the reason I was comfortably agnostic was because I knew maybe too strong, but I highly suspected that if we had a deflationary impulse move whereby gold went down along with everything else, the Fed would run in and save the day, and that's exactly what happened. So I think it's all liquidity driven at this point.
It's liquidity driven, and it doesn't seem to really reach the real market, so the real economy, I should say. I think that was David Rosenberg who recently said there's only like an 8 or 9% correlation between the stock market, the S&P 500, and the economy. So it's pretty disturbing, and it seems as though what happens is money flows into the financial sector, and the people who are already very wealthy are getting even wealthier relative to the masses, and it really
seems to be. That's exactly right. And when you said that, it may be that the wealthy people get hurt too. Yes, at some point, but not yet, right? Because what fiat currency, what printing money does, is it concentrates wealth at the top, and everyone else loses. And so, if you look at, for example, income distributions since 1971. Yeah, they're pretty steady through 71, and then we went off the gold standard, and it just went berserk, right? To the top, whatever it is, 1%, 10%, however you measure, 0.1%, starts getting all the gains, and that's endemic to an inflationary economy. We saw that trend accelerate after 2008 because of all the money printing, because all the bailouts, the bank bailouts, all the money flowed up to the top, and we saw that. In part because as little firms failed, because they couldn't reach the bailouts the big firms got, right? The private equity firms ran in and bought them all. And so the percentage of the economy that's controlled by big money interests, by centralized command and control companies, went up, right? And now the same thing's going to happen this time, where it's a bigger crisis. They're going to put more money. More money is going to go to the people, the important people who command lots of assets, and they'll wind up buying up all the sectors of the economy that don't have that access to that bailout money, and we'll find the economy is even more centralized than it was before. So the number of rich people keeps going down, but the people in that favored class
we'll keep getting richer as long as this system keeps going. And I keep seeing headlines saying, hey, since the panic began, billionaires have made, I forget the number, it's, you know, actually $300 billion, some you know, enormous mm-hmm. amounts of money because their stocks have gone up. Mm-hmm. and this is why, because they are in the flow of liquidity. And so they don't care what happens to the real economy. It is not inconsistent to have bread lines for the working class and the rich people be really rich. It's not sustainable, and it's not a equilibrium, and of course it won't last forever. But as long as they're willing to put the money, they can push it a very long time. And the only question for gold investors, I think, is how far can they push it? How near the end are we getting? And I suspect we're getting near the end, but it's hard to say exactly what it is. And in any case, I think when the end comes and the market actually stages a run on the Federal Reserve, and that's what I'm looking for as an end game, right? As you may, and your listeners may know, until World War I, every Western central bank in the world was on the gold standard, and you could show at the bank with an ounce of gold in your hand and hand it over, and they give you paper money, or vice versa. You could show up with paper money, your dollars or pounds or francs or whatever they are, and say, I want gold, and they would give it to you. And that stopped in World War after World War I, and stopped in the U.S. in the 30s. But the two were entirely convertible, and it would happen that there would be runs on central banks where people would show up at the central bank and say, hey, you know, we don't trust you anymore, give us the gold, and the bank would literally close its doors. I mean, that happened it made the Great Depression happen in Austria and places like that, Germany and England. And so now, obviously, you can't do that. You can't go to the Fed and say, hey, here are my dollars, give me gold. But what you can do is you can take your money and go to a coin store and say, I don't want these dollars, give me gold. And so the way the market stages a run on a central bank today is it says, we don't trust you, we don't trust the value of your assets, so we're going to mark up gold, which is on your balance sheet, to a price that backs your liabilities. And that, you know, as the Fed's balance sheet keeps expanding, that number keeps going up. It's easy. I wrote a paper a few months ago talking about $10,000 gold, and that was before all this happened. And the numbers now are staggering. I mean, if the market stages run the Federal Reserve, prices are going well above $10,000 an ounce. So that's the real end game. But we don't even need that right now, because the model right now is, I think, the 2008 collapse, the 2009 money printing, and we all know that for a good 2-3 years after that, they intentionally devalued the dollar to enable debts to become more easily paid. And they'll do the same thing today. And so gold has to go up anyway for their sake to keep the system solvent. So I expect gold to go up no matter what happens. And then the question will be 2 or 3 years down the road when we're looking from a much higher level. All right, is this the end game when gold is going to go up another a few fold, or are we going to have another big credit bubble and then gold will have a tough road for a little bit?
Yeah, that's the question. Will there be another bubble? Will there be another credit cycle before there's some of a major reset of the system. You know, most people, I dare say we may have a billionaire or two lurking on this show listening in, but most of us are more average people, upper middle class folks that listen to this show. So I hear what you're saying is that take your savings from fiat and put it into gold. You know, I think it was since the beginning of this century, if you just bought gold bullion, you would have outperformed Warren Buffett's investments, his fund that trades publicly, and I think that's pretty remarkable. But what you're saying now, you can almost count on it. It's not that gold rises in value; it's just that the currency becomes devalued.
It does rise in value, and you know, Warren Buffett will say it has no yield. That's actually not true. If you think about technology, as technology increases, it lowers costs. That's what it does. Now, it doesn't lower the cost necessarily in dollar terms because there's so much inflation in dollars. But if you look at the purchasing power of gold, it's gone way, way up. Another way of saying that, gold's purchasing power has stayed constant, and the cost of things have collapsed because of technology. So in fact, you get a purchasing power a dividend just by holding gold in a vault. And that's pretty compelling because there's no risk for that. Yeah. Right. So I'm not sure I agree with that.
Not sure. Okay. That's very good. I know some people take a look at, you know, what an ounce of gold would buy back in Roman times and compare it now. But what you say, obviously, you know, with technology that can do things and add efficiency in manufacturing or medicine or whatever you're talking about.
Or innovation.
About.
Innovation.
Yeah. Exactly. So, at the very least, then, at least what you're doing is preserving your wealth
That's right.
Rather than holding it and very possibly doing better. So average people can, you know, they can protect themselves. That's the point of this, and that's what I think we're trying to get at. Dan, with
that's
just,
exactly right. And Jeff, you know, and they don't protect themselves with bank balances, right? Because the interest rate is paid zero, there's inflation. So they actually lose when they got deposits in the bank system, whereas when you hold gold bullion over time, you increase purchasing power, which is the point of savings. So it's a natural thing to do.
Dan, I'd like to ask you a little bit about, I mean, you alluded to the 2008 situation where they printed enormous amounts of money. I guess what I'd like to ask you, first of all, is, are we facing, is this a liquidity crisis or are we facing an insolvency crisis or both?
Well, of course. From the Fed's perspective, there's no distinction because they say, oh, nothing is an insolvency crisis, it's all liquidity. What they mean is if we print enough money, we can bail everyone out. And that's true. That happened in 2008, right? Of course, it's a solvency crisis. But if you print up $3 trillion and sprinkle it around and then Wall Street levers it up, then no one goes bankrupt. And you say, hey, see, it was liquidity. It was insolvency. No one went bankrupt. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's the same thing now. I mean, we have been living, we are living in the greatest credit bubble the world has ever seen. Of course, all these institutions should be insolvent because they're chock-a-block full of malinvestments. And the only reason they're not is because the Fed bails at the banks that provides the credit for these things. And so it's the two. There is no distinction in a credit bubble. I mean, of course, it's both.
Right. Okay, so we started seeing the current problems arise before COVID-19. We started seeing issues back in September of last year with the repo crisis. Talk to us a little bit about the repo crisis. What is the repo market? And then why is it so important and why is it really tipping us off to something bigger going on?
All right. Well, I'll try to condense it. In the tax break model, you deposit a dollar in the bank and they lend out $10. And that's the fractured bank system. And they generally buy treasury bonds because that's the reserve asset. And then they finance mortgages, all sorts of other things. What the repo market is the shadow bank system. So people say, I don't want to put my money in the bank. Because there are FDIC limits and things like that. So I'll put it in a money market fund. So the money market fund becomes like a center deposit, like a bank. And that fund then goes out and buys treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities to AAA rated stuff. And they can lever that stuff up 20 times. Right? They can deposit a bank and borrow against it. They can lever it up. So that's how they get a return on your cash, is by taking your overnight funds and going to buy a year or 2 year out AAA rated paper. And that now system is now what funds the housing market and the treasury market. It's not really the banks. It's more those structures. And so what happened in September was, because the trigger was that there was a big tax payment due, or corporate taxes were due September 15th. So all sorts of corporations withdrew money from their money market accounts to pay their taxes to the treasury. And all of a sudden these guys discover they own these, a year long treasury bond, but they borrow money overnight. And so all of a sudden they couldn't borrow the money because the banks wouldn't lend it to them, because the banks had their own limits. And so the repo market went collapsed, essentially. Interest rates went to 10%. Well, of course, as you know, at a 10% interest rate environment, Wall Street would just disappear. So with the private equity industry, it's just untenable. So the Fed ran in and said, hey, we will lend money into this market to shore it up. And this is just a temporary problem because it was a tax payment issue. And again, it was a trigger. But then it was, we need more liquidity for a quarter-end balancing. As you probably know, these guys, there's something called repo, I think 105s, where on the last day of the quarter, all these banks and other players sell all their assets, or of course their assets, and then agree to buy back the next day. And why do they do that? They do that so they can report to the SEC and their investors they have left leverage than they actually have. So it's basically fraud, and the Fed enables it by saying, oh, we know they're going to do it, so we'll liquefy it to enable them to do it. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. But the problem still didn't go away, so then they said, it's going to be year-end rebalancing, and they kept having excuses, and then, of course, the problem never went away. And so the question was, is there too little cash? And that's what the Fed thought, there's too little cash. But the flip side is, were there too many treasury bonds and too many mortgage-backed securities for the existing cash to finance, which, of course, is also true. And so they only looked at the cash side. They didn't look at the supply side of the demand for this money. So the point is that the bubble is already teetering because there were too many of these assets that have been overbuilding in housing and commercial real estate and, of course, much too much deficit spending. And that's what's blowing up. And so the Fed said, hey, by liquefying this market, and that's the word they liquefy, by printing money and lending this market, we're going to keep rates where we want them. But what they really were doing was printing money to finance deficits and to finance housing construction and office building construction. That's what they were doing. And the Fed had to do it because the bubble was fraying. And so, again, that was already happening when the Wuhan virus showed up. And then when you have a sudden stop, in an equity economy, like everyone tightens their belt and for a few months and then go on as before, so what, right? But when you have to have a sudden stop where everyone owes huge amounts of debt and the debt payments aren't coming, well, that's a major problem. It's the Fed now has to print up all those interest payments that nobody can make because there's no economic activity happening while the economy is shut down. You know, the question is when they restart up again, the Fed has this idea that they can get some of that back, which is what Bernanke promised us in 2009 and 10, as you recall. Oh, it was just temporary. It would cause inflation. If it were permanent, but it's not permanent, we're going to pull it back. Of course, they couldn't pull it back when they tried. The economy almost blew up. And they'll discover the same thing this time. When they try to get the money back, the economy will teeter, and they won't be able to do it. So this money's out there. It's not coming back. And it's going to have huge, huge implications on the currency, on markets, and gold, and all sorts of things.
Right. I mean, under normal circumstances, if we could ever get back to it, you'd let the rates rise to clear the market so you can have real price discovery of capital and then efficient allocation of capital instead of suppressing the price and then all kinds of malinvestment
takes place. That's right. And that's what Volcker did, and there was – the debt level was small enough, so it was painful in 1980 when it happened, but we survived. There's no way that the world can survive 20% interest rates. I mean, today, it would be a horrible, horrible depression. They just can't allow it.
Right. And everywhere you look, Dan, I mean, it's just hard to see with revenues collapsing in almost every sector. A few of them are actually benefiting, I suppose, but for the most part, almost every sector you look at, except for the people that deliver things, or I think gold is doing well. Gold mining shares are doing well, and I'm looking at some projected earnings for the top larger gold mining companies are looking very strong right now. So I think that's an area that people can do well in. But it's just hard to see. I mean, it's hard for me to comprehend the massive amount of destruction, the massive amount of shortfall and losses and layoffs and the amount of money that has to be printed. I mean, to try to fill the gap. Dan, it doesn't seem possible. I mean, we're looking at a hyperinflation of the currency. Whether or not that results in hyperinflated prices, I don't know. But, I mean, how many trillions of dollars is the Fed going to have to print? I mean, all the states that are in trouble, they want money now.
That's right.
So,
and apparently, the CBA already says the deficit this year is going to be $3.5 trillion. That's the deficit. And that's before they pass the next stimulus bill, which they're already working on. And so to answer your question, I think the Fed's printed $3 trillion on its balance sheet. Congress has already committed to spending another $3 trillion, or $2.5 trillion actually. They're going to add a trillion or two to that. So it's going to be trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. And one thing that I make reference in the piece I wrote recently, which you referenced, is that the QE after 2009 was – reserves to the banks. It wasn't a helicopter drop of money to consumers. It was reserves to the banks, and the banks use the reserves to go lend against the construction of assets like buildings and power plants and that kind of thing. And so then you get overcapacity, and prices actually come down in some areas, right? But in the meantime, you get lots of employment, and it's got sugar high, the Keynesian sugar high you get.
Yes.
This is not that, right? This is money being given to workers who aren't working, right, so they can buy stuff, which is great, but nothing against the workers, but the point is when you do that, you're not creating more assets that back this currency. You're just funding current expenditure. And that's why I think these QEs are very, very unlike the QEs in 2009 and 10. I think these QEs go directly to consumer spending, which is going to push consumer prices way, way, way higher as soon as they reopen the economy. And that's a huge distinction. And gold is just going to absolutely love that. So that's a big difference.
You end your essay, three possible outcomes. What are those three possible outcomes, and which one do you think is most likely?
Yeah, so, I mean, the first outcome is that the Fed just simply doesn't have what it takes to print as much money as they need to. And the example I give is if you lend Boeing $10 billion tomorrow, right, they would repay their existing debts for sure, but nobody's ordering airplanes right now. And so this is this Keynesian pushing on a string scenario where it doesn't matter how much debt you put out and there's no demand, and so therefore you wind up in a depression. I think that's the least likely because I think that the government always will spend money and they can live money to the government. Again, the whole DNA of the economics profession is to avoid that outcome. So I don't think that is going to work. And then another outcome is that the Fed prints all this money, and Wall Street siphons a lot of it out, which, of course, is actually happening. And there's a huge part in the asset market. So the asset markets go absolutely bananas, and we get the S&P goes to new record highs and then some. And meanwhile, economic performance in everywhere else has collapsed. And so, again, there's that scenario where you get this weird scenes of breadlines and then also Wall Street having a party, which doesn't seem possible because Wall Street's supposed to reflect the real economy. But, of course, again, it doesn't. So that's option number two. And option number three, which could happen now or could happen after option number two, it depends on the timing, it's just a currency collapse, right? When if you look at historical instances where the governments fund themselves through money printing and not taxes, and this year and next year is going to be, like 40% or some number like that or more, usually you wind up with a currency crisis. And so by printing so many treasury bonds, can the Fed really keep rates at zero? And that's what they said they're going to do. They're going to buy as many treasury bonds as it takes to keep rates at zero. That's their policy. That's what they want them. But I mean, my goodness, the Fed, the Treasury is going to have to sell. It was $1 trillion a year anyway before this happened. Now it's going to be $4 trillion of deficits. The Fed's got to buy all those things, and then if the market spooked, they may have to buy everyone else's treasuries too. In other words, if countries start dumping these things because they're toxic, and all of a sudden, you could have what does rapidly become a Weimar situation where the central bank is the only buyer of the government bonds, and so you have a massive increase in currency and credit in the bank system, and then you wind up in a semi hyperinflation unless they let the government fail, essentially, and that's unimaginable. So I think that has a very likelihood of happening just simply because of the magnitude of what they're doing to the central bank's balance sheet and the currency. In the latter two scenarios, gold does well on a nominal basis and a real basis. And the first one, gold does well on a real basis, but not obviously a nominal basis because oil prices will collapse. So you'll think, oh my God, I shouldn't have bought gold because gold is going down in price, but you'll discover it's actually going up in purchasing power. And also is a critical point, which is that you say, well, dollars are great, but in scenario number one, the banks will fail and they'll be worked out. And so your deposits might not be available. So, yeah, theoretically, holding dollars is better. But unless you have a suitcase of cash in your basement, right, if it's in the bank, you may not be able to get to the cash. And then the suitcase, the police will show up and say, you must be a drug dealer, and they'll take it. So it's not obvious how you protect your purchasing power through raw dollars in that scenario anyway. So gold's probably a good place to be in any case.
Yeah. Well, so
I hate to be so sure. You never want to be so certain. Well, this investment's definitely going to work out. I mean, other things happen. I guess it's possible that we get a credit bubble like from 2009 to now, and gold is under pressure. But it's just hard to imagine that scenario happening again, given what's happening in the economy today, and given the magnitude of the Treasury's response and the Fed's response. That seems like an unlikely outcome, but I mean, one has to acknowledge it's possible.
Yeah. Dan, just to clarify, maybe real quickly, the difference between outcome number two and outcome number three,
yeah,
if you could.
Two is we get an intensification of the past 10 years, right? So Tesla goes screaming higher, like Wall Street goes higher, like Apple, Microsoft, all these things are going higher. There's no real currency crisis. Rates stayed zero, right? Wall Street's having a great time. Everyone actually works for a living is having a terrible time. They can't make their rent. Their jobs getting squeezed, getting fired, all that business, right? And which is again a dichotomy, but it's possible. Number three is you get a currency crisis where rates go to 10-20%, right? And Wall Street blows up, and the dollar goes down 90% in value, and you get a third world style currency crisis. And then they'll put capital controls on everywhere, and you'll see much more a hard control of capital in the economy by the government. But that's a very different outcome.
So that would mean that the Fed would be unable to keep interest rates at zero. There'd be a loss of confidence in the currency itself.
That's right.
People wouldn't want the currency. They would dump it. They would buy tangible assets, causing prices to rise.
Either the Fed loses control of interest rates, so they just give up and rates go crazy and then the banks collapse, or the Fed is forced printing $20 trillion, some number like that, right, to not just buy the deficit money, the new deficit money, but all the other holders of treasuries that now went out of the market. And so rates do stay at zero, but the increase in currency is so tremendous that the value of the dollar collapses anyway. So those are two different variants of that same outcome. That's what a currency collapse looks like.
I mean, I'm trying to get my head around why the Fed wouldn't be able to just suppress the rates because people just wouldn't accept the currency.
Imagine if the Fed got in a position where, again, they had to buy every incremental treasury bond plus every treasury bond in the market they were selling because they're spooked because they don't want to hold the currency because the currency is losing value, right? And all of a sudden, what's the current treasury bond portfolio of the Fed today? I mean, if you don't count the Social Security, it's like $20 trillion or something, or will be soon, right? So the Fed all of a sudden has to buy $20 trillion of treasury bonds, okay? And then they're going to say, oh, my God, you know, we've just increased the amount of base currency by seven times, like, you know, in the next year or two, right? And then they say, well, okay, banks, we can't let you use the fraction of process. If you do that, there'll be another $100 trillion of money. Well, we can't have that because then the currency completely collapses. But you could have a collapse anyway of foreigners who say, we don't want to have dollars because the Fed just printed out $20 trillion of them. I mean, that is a possible outcome.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, obviously, President Trump is worried about that because there was some talk about the United States reneging on its repayment of treasuries.
That's political. I mean, that's saying, yeah. You know, China, you caused this problem.
Yeah, but, Dan.
$1 trillion, we'll just write it off.
But, Dan, we were able to live beyond our means for so long because of the kindness of strangers.
True.
The foreigners were buying treasuries. That seems to be waning in any event, doesn't it? Isn't it? Or do you think that because of the liquidity of the dollar and the relatively higher interest rates, at almost zero, but nonetheless still positive, slightly?
Well, this is a slightly different topic, which is that the dollar is currently still the funding currency of the world. And so, as I've talked about elsewhere, there was $3 trillion of base money, now there's more like six. And there's $90 trillion of debt in dollar terms. So if you don't pay your dollar debts, you lose your collateral, right? You default. And no one wants that. And so there's a huge demand international for dollars to pay your debts. Well, again, if the dollar collapses in value so you can pay your debts back easily, that's a problem for the reserve currency status, right? Or if everyone defaults, that's not a problem because now you don't own dollars anymore. Everyone just say, we're not paying you, sorry. And the reason that hasn't happened in the past is because if you're a country like Argentina, for example, you agree to a workout because you want to access international markets again and get more dollar debts. I mean, that's insane, but you do because you're a politician. You want to spend all the money today. You know, we're going to spend tomorrow, so you want to borrow as much as you can. And everyone wants that, and so the dollar continues through these organizations set up after World War II. Right? But if you had a currency crisis in the dollar, all that would go away. And all of a sudden, you would lose what I think Jacques Rouff called the exorbitant privilege of the United States, to the ability to run deficit without tears. And imagine, Jay, if the Congress actually had to balance the budget, like all of a sudden, because the market just cut up the credit
card.
Social trauma and the economic pain that would come along.
Yeah.
My goodness.
And the rates of interest that would be required. Yeah, it's not fathomable to us who have enjoyed
this. It's not fathomable, but it will happen. I mean, that's the thing.
All right. Dan, I think that, you know, to try to say where the price of gold is going is really impossible to say. But Jim Rickards on the show suggests 14,000. He explained his reasoning. I mean, do you care to – you mentioned 10,000. But, I mean, this is a moving target because the money –
It's a moving target, Jay. But the point is, the way I look at it, is look at the Fed's balance sheet. Now, Jim Rickards and I disagree about that because he says, well, the Fed has no gold on its balance sheet, it's all the Treasury Department. And my point is that's totally irrelevant. The Treasury Department balance sheet and the Fed's balance sheet are essentially the same thing. It's the government's balance sheet. This is the government script, and there's that much gold. We think, right? Now, as you know, no one's seen it since the 50s, but let's assume it's there. If you assume it's there and you say to yourself, at what price does gold have to go to, now, not 100% backing it, but to provide a reasonable backing the dollar, 50%, two-thirds in a crisis, some number like that, yeah, you get up to $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 an ounce. Now, if the gold's not actually there, if Larry Summers stole it all, which I think is possible, then that number goes a lot higher. So, I mean, treasury bonds won't be worth zero. I mean, you know, there'll always be some tax revenue, some economic activity. They just won't be worth 30-year bonds won't be trading at 2%. Yield, right? And so they'll go down in value by 70%, 80%, 90%, some number like that.
Well, Jim Rickards worked in intelligence. Maybe he knows something we don't know. I don't know. but in any event, thank you so much, Dan, for being with us. And, you know, I think the point that we want to make is that people need to own gold and gold shares secondarily.
Yes.
I'm extremely excited about the gold share markets, and I think you are too. I know at least one company that you own that I like a lot as well. And so I think that people need to look at, you know, ways to preserve wealth and for the benefit of their friends and their families. So thank you very much for helping to explain this all to us, Dan, and all the best to you and to you and yours. Take care.
Thanks, Jack.
All right, folks. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to have Axel Merck and Alistair MacLeod with us. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.